All right, well, thank you, David, for setting everything up, and thank you all for showing up tonight. This is the first of four classes that we'll do this weekend and next weekend on one of the great classics of world spiritual literature, the Bhagavad Gita, the song. Gita means song. Bhagavad means to the Lord, and the Lord in this case is called Krishna. But it's the same Lord. It's the same Lord that you all have down there in the Bible Belt. Same one. So doesn't matter what you call him or her or it. So that'll be one of the themes that we'll be exploring here. Who the hell is Krishna anyway? Who's God? What's God? And this is also the third of a series of such classes. Courses, Middleway Center courses, we're calling them, on this text. And I'm very happy to have the opportunity to teach this text again. I've taught this text my whole life. I've studied and taught this text my whole life. I first was introduced to the Bhagavad Gita in a philosophy course that I took in college. And I had a professor there, which is somewhat unusual to have a professor in a philosophy department who was interested in Eastern philosophy. And he introduced me to the Bhagavad Gita. And then I went to graduate school in South Asian religions, and of course studied the Bhagavad Gita there. And then I taught the Bhagavad Gita in classes of various sorts at the university for over 20 years, 25 years. And since then, I've taught the Bhagavad Gita as a spiritual text, as a practical text, for the last 15 years, off and on. And so this is a scripture that's very near and dear to my heart. I've found there are days when I wake up somewhat on the wrong side of the bed. Maybe that's happened to you once or twice. And just picked up this text and looked at it and got myself right. The great classics of spiritual literature are like that. They're timeless. You know, that's why they're classics, is that they're not the specifically, rooted in any particular historical moment, but rather stretch over all time, are relevant to all time. And they're also, universal. So Bhagavad Gita, for example, was written in India 2,000 years ago or so, but it's as pertinent to us in our culture here and now as it was for them back then. That's what makes a classic, and we're very fortunate. Probably don't really realize how fortunate we are to have at our fingertips, texts like this translated into our own language that we can always revert back to. And, so these Middleway courses that I've been putting together over the last 3-4 years, almost all of them, one or two exceptions, are based on the great classics of the Sanskrit tradition of India. But each and every one of them isn't just, for ancient Indians. Therefore, they're relevant to us too. And so that'll be, kind of the angle that we'll be working on the Bhagavad Gita. How can it help us live a better life? And that's another reason why it's a classic, really. The questions that it asks, the questions that it addresses are timeless and universal. And, the question that the Bhagavad Gita raises and then answers is the same one that pretty much every authentic spiritual classic will do. How do we live, how do we live a good life? The Gita has a little bit of a spin on that. How do we live a good life in a messy world? And in case you didn't notice, our world is messy. There's lots of problems. There's lots of ways in which the world isn't the way we want it to be. It isn't ideal, that word ideal. Ideal is the opposite of real. If it were ideal, it wouldn't be real. But it's real. And therefore messy. Therefore, difficult, It's difficult to navigate. So the text, you know, kind of is set up in the first chapter. It begins with one of the two main protagonists, Arjuna, one of the two only protagonists, actually. It's a conversation between Arjuna, who's a warrior, which kind of stands in, you know, symbolically for a man of action, somebody who is like living in the world, you know, not a monk or a nun or a world renouncer living in some, you know, monastery or in a cave somewhere, but somebody in the thick of it, you know, somebody who has things that they need to do in life, responsibilities that they need to carry out. And then there's Krishna. Krishna is Arjuna's best friend, actually. Old boyhood chums go way back, and Krishna is serving in the capacity of a charioteer to his friend Arjuna, and they're getting ready for for a big showdown, a big battle, and Arjuna asks Krishna to, you know, take the chariot and bring it into no man's land, into the DMZ zone, and park the chariot there. And Arjuna looks over at his enemy, who he is, you know, kind of required as a soldier, as a warrior, to kill. And he looks over and he sees his own relatives. It's a war. It's like the Hatfields and McCoys, you know. Down south there, you know, it's a kind of a feud, a war between two sides of the same family. They're all related in a way, but so Arjuna is in a pickle. You know, he looks over at his enemy, and he says, "Well, these are my relatives. How can I kill them? That would be wrong. That would be a great sin." You know. To be killing my cousins, my uncles, my teachers. He sees his gurus, as part of the opposing army and all like that. And so, you know, the whole first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, you know, is sometimes called the Arjuna's Shoka. Shoka means grief or depression, you could say. He's paralyzed. You know, he doesn't know what to do. You could think of the Bhagavad Gita as a kind of a South Asian Hamlet. You know, for those of you who know the Shakespeare play, where, you know, to be or not to be. You know, I'm frozen here. I don't know what to do in life. And, you know, maybe you've been in a situation like that in your life. I know I have. Maybe you're in a situation like that now in your life. You know, sometimes there are big ones where, you know, everything's just kind of crumbled. All the security that we've kind of, you know, depended on just like folds up. The door opens up underneath us and we're left, you know, kind of wondering what now in life as a whole, in our lives as a whole. That's happened to me a couple times in my life. And then there's like the, you know, the smaller versions of it where we find ourselves in situations where we just don't know what to do. We don't know what the right thing is to do. And so this question that the Bhagavad Gita, you know, raises, what do I do? How do I live? You know, Arjuna's grief, Arjuna's depression. What do I do now? Now that I'm in this, like, you know, major kind of conundrum, this major, like, crossroads in life. How do I live? So the Gita is a classic in that it's the same question that we all have at one time or another in the big way, and then in an ongoing way as we go through life. You know, what do I do here? How do I live my life here in a messy world? In a world where it's not clear cut. What the right thing to do is and the wrong thing to do is. You know, sometimes we're fortunate enough to have that sense that yeah, I know what the right thing is to do here. But oftentimes it's not so clear cut. Oftentimes there's a lot of gray area. So the Bhagavad Gita is set in the gray area of life. You know, where things are not black and white, where things are not like easy to figure out. And so it raises a classic question, and then it gives a kind of a classic answer, actually. The Bhagavad Gita specifically offers offers us three different methods, three different what they call yogas in the Bhagavad Gita. For those of you who don't know, yoga is all the rage, and Bhagavad Gita is all about yoga. Not a single asana, not a single physical position is described in the Bhagavad Gita, but yoga is used over and over and over again, in all kinds of formations in the Sanskrit and in the Bhagavad Gita. So the Krishna, who is, the teacher here, and who also turns out to be God, offers Arjuna three different methods for how to live a life in a messy world. And as we'll see by next weekend, these three methods turn out to be all just one method. But it's presented as three different options, okay? So it's a little tricky, it's a little clever, because it's not really three different options, it's all the same. It's all just one option. But anyway, for clarity, in order to help us get our heads around this question, what do I do? How do I live a good life? Krishna says, well, there's three different ways that you can do it, depending on your inclination. And I would say, so it's like three different personality types, three different methods for three different personality types. You could think of it that way. Or you could think of it as three different methods for the same person at different times, you could think of it also as three different methods that are, kind of more appropriate or less appropriate for people living in different cultures at different times in history. The first one, which I did a whole course on, broadcast like this to the folks in LA, is called the Yoga of Wisdom. The Yoga of Wisdom. Jnana Yoga. And this is for people who depend on their heads. Okay, and so like I said just a minute ago, I think you can think of our time and place as one in which the Yoga of Wisdom is particularly apropos, because we are all extremely well educated. We all do depend on our heads a lot, and I don't care who you are. Everyone in this room has got the benefit of education unprecedented in world history. So, when you think about the time span of the Bhagavad Gita, how many people were there that, could really analyze things in the past, who really had the tools, the intellectual tools, to really think things through properly? And not many, actually. Not many at all. But now we're in a time where we're all, kind of able to do that. If we actually do it, if it becomes a yoga. Yoga means a discipline. So the Yoga of Wisdom, Jnana Yoga, actually includes two parts. It includes what they call in Sanskrit Buddhi Yoga. Buddhi, B-U-D-D-H-I, which means the intellect, the rational mind. And that's very much part of what's meant in the Bhagavad Gita by this first method. Use your head. Think it out. Figure it out. Don't be ruled by your mental afflictions. Don't be ruled by your negative emotions, but use your head. What's best here? What's the best for me and everyone around me? That's one sort of aspect. Then the other aspect of the Yoga of Wisdom is, I guess you might think of it as intuition. It's non-conceptual wisdom. Which means what the vibe is, how do you feel, in an intellectual sense, in a rational sense, but not using the concepts and theories and words and ideas that we usually associate with the mind. The mind is also capable of non-conceptual thinking, and this is, of course, what happens full on in a mystical experience. Is that you know something, as a result of the mystical experience, you know something, but you can't really put it into words. When you try to put it into words, it dilutes it or perverts it in some way or another. So this is very common in the world's spiritual history, is the idea that that there are experiences that we have that we just can't talk about. You know, the seeing of the divine, the seeing of the sacred, the having this kind of transcendent experience, the experience of getting in touch with something much bigger than yourself. This sense of awe that comes from, like, you know, for example, if you go out into the country and look at the sky, you know, on a cloudless, you know, clear night, and just contemplate, like, the universe, the cosmos, you know, you can kind of get there. You can kind of get to that sense of just being awestruck and therefore dumbstruck. Therefore, it's like, you know, your jaw just opens up and no words come out of it. No words come out of your mouth. And that's another aspect of the yoga wisdom. And we're going to have a whole session next weekend where that happens to Arjuna. Arjuna has a full-blown mystical experience. It's a very famous, maybe not as famous as it should be, the 11th chapter. And I've translated the whole of the 11th chapter for that class, which is kind of the culmination of the Bhagavad Gita, you know, where Krishna, God, also known as God, reveals himself, gives Arjuna what they call darshan, a view of who God really is, you know, and it's overwhelming and beyond words. Although, of course, the other thing that they all do, and mystics worldwide, is I've had this experience, I can't say anything about it, let me try. And then they go all like, you know, it's like this, it's like that, it's like, you know, rivers running into the sea. They start metaphor, you know, they lapse into metaphor because you can't capture it into ordinary language. So that's the first thing the first method. And it's very, like I said, appropriate for us. We should use our heads. We're able to use our heads. We have the education, the training to be able to use our heads to figure out, like, what's what in life. And it's only kind of laziness and the habituation to a kind of an ignorance that prevents us from figuring things out. It's not that we can't. It's just that we're used to delusion. We're accustomed to being ignorant, actually, about the way things are. Then there's a second yoga. The second method is karma yoga. Now, yeah, that's a word that's now become an English word, I guess. Karma here means action, the yoga of action, how to act in the world properly. And I'll review these by, you know, in a second. We'll look at some of the passages that sort of capture what the teachings are. I'm just going to doing a quick overview here of the three methods. But karma yoga involves acting properly in the world, which, you know, kind of as a way of summing it up, means acting as selflessly as possible, acting without, you know, the overweening self-interest that guides pretty much every one of our actions, unless they are disciplined, unless they are yogified, yogaized, or something like that. And then the third method. And so, you know, maybe you can see how these are kind of timeless and universal. You know, there are people who like to use their heads, who like to think, who are, you know, who are oriented towards the, you know, kind of the intellect, and then the, you know, kind of deeper non-conceptual ways of using your head. And then there are people who are, you know, active, and many of us are like that too. You know, we're not, you know, even in spiritual circles, we're not sitting around meditating, you know, 12, 16 hours a day in a cave somewhere. You know, we got stuff to do. We got a job, we got a family, we got, you know, social relationships to maintain. We've got a world that needs us to, you know, to do what we can to help it. So the second yoga is for active people, and we're also like that way. We're active, all of us. And of course, you know, this is especially good for a warrior. So, you know, Krishna's teaching Arjuna how to act in the world properly, by disciplining your actions, which basically means disciplining the mind, that and especially the intention of your actions. So we'll come back to that. Then the third yoga, the third method, is the one that this this course is really centered on. And that's what's called bhakti yoga, B-H-A-K-T-I, bhakti. Bhakti means devotion. So the yoga of devotion. So you have the yoga of wisdom, which is using your head. You've got the yoga of karma yoga, the yoga of action, which is using your body, you know, is acting in the world with your body. And then the third one is the yoga of devotion, which is about the heart. Is about disciplining your feelings, you could say. Yoking your feelings to a proper object. So we'll be talking the whole 2 weekends about, you know, the kind of different angles on that. I'll just give you a little preview. One of the themes that we'll be exploring kind of over and over again is the fact that we're all devoted to something already. Okay, it's not like that devotion is a foreign concept or a foreign kind of, you know, idea or method to us. We're all devoted to something. The question is, what is it that we're devoted to, and is it a proper object of devotion? Is it a useful object of devotion to bring us happiness in life? To bring us the kind of happiness and joy that we're all looking for in life. So it's not that we don't have devotion. It's not that we don't have faith. We all have faith too. Faith and devotion kind of go hand in hand. And we'll be exploring some of the ins and outs of faith, which is, you know, a big mistake to think that faith doesn't, and the faith and reason don't go together. They have to go together. You can't have blind faith. Blind faith won't stand, you know. You might try it for a little while, but unless the whole being is behind what it is that you have faith in, which includes the intellect, which includes the reason, you know, then the faith is not solid. It's not substantial. So we're not talking here about blind faith. You know, I grew up in the Baptist tradition. It wasn't in the South, but you know, I know from the Bible Belt, okay, a little bit. And a lot of times you hear in the you know, that kind of like discourse, that kind of Christian discourse, you know, sort of the suggestion at least that to just like, you know, lock your mind away and just believe, you know? Don't think about it too much. Just believe and everything will work out, okay? And that's a very, very naive and superficial understanding of faith. There are way deeper levels of faith. And so we'll be looking at those deeper levels. And like I said, the deeper levels do not require you to check your mind at the door. That really just won't work. Over the long run, it won't work. If you're going to have deep faith, a faith that will take you through the hard times, faith that will challenge you, you know, that it's got to be involved with the mind. The mind has to be in the equation there. So anyway, those are a little bit of an overview of the Bhagavad Gita as a whole. Its classic nature in terms both of the questions that it raises, the question, how to live especially in a world that isn't ideal, where stuff happens that we didn't want to happen, and then the classic sort of approach, the classic methods, which if you think about it, I think you can see those three aspects of a spiritual life in any spiritual tradition. There's the aspect that emphasizes, you know, reason, theology, for example, in the Christian tradition, that emphasizes reason. Then there's the aspect that emphasizes service, you know, karma yoga, doing something. And then there's the aspect that emphasizes faith and devotion. So I think you can see that these three yogas aren't just specific to the Bhagavad Gita, you know. Bhagavad Gita you know, puts it into those words, into those concepts. But those ideas, those concepts, those methods are found universally in any spiritual tradition. And just one more thing. I mean, a complete spiritual practice would involve all three, I think. A complete individual spiritual practice. So to some degree or another, all three probably need to be present in any one of our practices as individuals. All right, let's turn to the text. Everyone got the reading? I can see you, so you can shake your head, yes or no. All right, good. So, class one, getting beyond the ego. All three of these yogas are meant to do this. All three of these disciplines are meant to do this. And this, of course, also is a universal feature of a spiritual life. The spiritual life, no matter what sort of, you know, brand you're practicing, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, New Ageism, you know, if it's an authentic spiritual tradition, it's meant to get you beyond your ego. A spiritual tradition practiced as if it were meant to prop up your ego isn't an authentic spiritual tradition at all. It's a psychology. You know, psychology is meant to do that. And fortunately, we also live in a day and age where we have very sophisticated, you know, psychological methodologies and, you know, therapies and all of that. And so if you need your ego propped up, you can hire a therapist. That's their job, actually. And I don't know how many of you have been to therapy, but, you know, here's what therapy is, okay? You go and pay somebody a lot of money to listen to you whine about your problems. And then the therapist is meant to try to help you find ways to feel better about yourself and your problems. And this is a very important function in life. I've been to therapy. There are times when it's very important to take advantage of the therapeutical establishment that we have at our fingertips, actually, everyone here. But that's not a spiritual life. Spiritual life is not therapy. Spiritual life isn't to make you feel better about yourself. It's to get you out of yourself, actually. It's to help you find a higher self, which is not the ego, which is not the individual ego. So getting beyond the ego. So the first verse here just kind of summarizes what I was talking about in reviewing the first chapter. Arjuna's grief, his shoka. This is kind of, you know, after a whole first chapter of whining, you know, he gets to the second chapter, beginning of the second chapter, and here's kind of where he ends up, Arjuna, in his whining to Krishna. I am afflicted to my core by the flaw of deep depression. You know, he's stymied. If you've been depressed, you maybe know how he feels like. If you've, or even had like a really, really bad blue day, you just don't feel like doing anything, you know? You don't feel like getting out of bed. And so that's what Arjuna is expressing here. I don't feel like getting out of bed. I don't feel like, you know, I certainly don't feel like doing what it is I'm supposed to do. With my duty here as a warrior, which is to fight and to kill the enemy. So I'm stymied. I'm paralyzed, afflicted to my core by the flaw of deep depression. My mind is totally confused about right and wrong. It's a longish translation, right and wrong, of one word, dharma. Dharma. I'm confused about what's right. Dharma means, you know, the truth, the right way. Totally confused. I beg you to tell me clearly what is best. So this is the beginning of him surrendering to his teacher. I beg you to tell me clearly what is best. I am your student. Please teach me. I surrender myself to you. So, you know, this is the beginning. This is the beginning of any spiritual path that's going to be efficacious for you in the long run, is to surrender your pride, to surrender your ego, to surrender the idea that you can figure everything out on your own. And again, I don't know about you, but in my experience, this has happened. Where you hit the wall hard, and everything that you thought was working doesn't work anymore. All the theories of life that you had, you know, just go down the toilet, and kind of throw your arms up in despair and go like, well, what the hell am I supposed to do here? Nothing I thought would work has worked. And you're just humbled, actually. Humbled by life. Humbled by events. And this is the beginning. You open up then. You open up to the possibility that there's something that you need to learn that you don't know already. And without that, you know, not much progress possible. And we'll look at verses where, you know, where he talks about what most of us look like most of the time. And it's not like this. It's not like, you know, a person who is surrendering. It's a person who thinks that they're in control, that they've got life by the tail, and don't need no help from no one. You know, can do it on their own, can figure it out on their own, you know, until the rug comes out. So Arjuna has had the rug pulled out from underneath him. And I think, you know, I think we've all had some experience of that. And so that you have to kind of put your mind in that space, in that mind space of being open, like Arjuna is, open to being taught. So he surrenders. So you could also say that surrendering is an aspect of all three yogas. The yoga of the intellect, the yoga of wisdom, the yoga of karma, action, and especially the yoga of devotion. Surrendering in the yoga of wisdom means at some point surrendering the intellect also. The intellect, the reason, is part of the yoga of wisdom. But the truly smart people in life, you can check me out if you want. You know, you think about the people who are smartest that you know tend to be those people who know what they don't know. Okay? They're smart enough to know that there's a whole universe of stuff that they don't know. I saw this time and time again in the academic world. There's three kinds of academics. There's stupid academics, and there are some of those. Then there are like smart ass academics, you know, who think they know everything, and those are not the best academics at all. The best academics are the ones who are the real smart ones. Are the ones who know how much they don't know. They've explored a subject deep enough to know that there's no end to the depths of pretty much anything that you probe deep enough. Okay? So surrendering of the intellect, giving it up. The surrender of what they call the fruits of action. That's the surrender that's involved in the yoga of action. Surrendering what it is that you hope to get out of things when you do something. Surrendering the outcome of things. And doing your best, you know, doing whatever it is that there is to do to the best of your ability without thinking about whether this is going to pay off well for you or not. You see? Surrendering the ego. Surrendering the egoistic, you know, tendencies that we all have that guide our actions. What about me? What am I going to get out of this deal? And then here, of course, surrendering to somebody or to something bigger than you, because you don't know what to do, and devote yourself to it. So here he's surrendering to the teacher. And you know, in order to learn anything in any sort of walk of life, actually, you have to surrender to a teacher. If you want to learn how to play guitar well, you have to surrender to a guitar teacher. And I've been taking guitar lessons, you know, lately. And you know, you don't go into the lesson and say, you know, look at all the stuff I know. You go into the lesson and you say, teach me stuff I don't know. You know, and you shut up already. You know, you don't like say, oh, you know, I think you know, the teacher, I could teach it better, or you know, you're not quite right there, teacher, or you know, whatever. Like, you just shut up and learn. So the surrendering to a teacher of any sort is a necessary part of learning if you're interested in learning, and if you're interested in learning how to live. You know, it's kind of crucial to surrender yourself at some point to somebody you think can help you learn that. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to say earlier about the great privilege that we have of being able to study a text like this, the great classics, is that we can surrender ourselves to them too. We can surrender ourselves to the text itself. And so it doesn't have to be like a personal teacher. It helps to have a personal teacher for sure. But if you have the classic ideas, if you have the timeless universal teachings, you know, then you can surrender to them. So as an academic, when I was studying the Bhagavad Gita, I did not surrender to the Bhagavad Gita. It's not the academic way to surrender to a text. You analyze it, you probe it, you criticize it, you contextualize it, you show, you know, how it's influenced by the author or by the, you know, context, the culture, etc., etc. You explain it away, in a way. You don't surrender to it. But when we come to a text from the spiritual point of view, it's helpful, very helpful, to surrender to it. To, what do you call it? To suspend our disbelief. Like when we go to a movie. At David's recommendation, we went to see Inside Outside yesterday. Awesome movie, you gotta see it. It's amazing. And you know, we saw it in 3D too, which helps, I think, to surrender to you know, surrender your disbelief, to suspend your disbelief, and to enter into it. To enter into it uncritically, you know? And then, you know, after the movie's over, you can sit around and talk to your wife about this or that, criticizing, and, you know, that voice could have been done better by so-and-so, or, you know, whatever. But during the experience itself, you know, to surrender, to give into it, and to be enveloped by it, then you can really appreciate it. So, try to surrender to the text a little bit here. Try to surrender to the Bhagavad Gita. You know, later on you can analyze it and criticize it and you know, put it aside if you can. You know, Krishna actually says that at some point towards the end of the thing. He says, after like 18 chapters of teaching, he tells Arjuna, well, you know, this is what I taught you. Now do what you want with it. You know, I'm not going to like follow you around the rest of your life to make sure that you're doing what I taught you. It's up to us. It's up to us to, you know, kind of integrate it or not into our lives. So, but the first way to, you know, the first step is to figure out what you're integrating or not integrating into your life by surrendering to it and giving yourself over to the teachings, and then seeing if they don't reverberate with you. If the critical mind is like engaged from the very get-go, you won't hear the text. You won't hear the teachings. You'll just be sitting there analyzing them and criticizing them, that little inner critic that we all have. Everyone got that little voice inside? Yeah. That little voice is whining and criticizing our whole lives. You know, that's why we suffer, you could say. That's why we're having such a hard time of it. It's because that little voice doesn't shut up very often. And so Arjuna's little voice is definitely shut up here. He says, okay, I'm done. I can't figure this out for the life of me. I don't know what to do. So you tell me, Krishna. You tell me what to do, and I'll try to learn it. And this is in the second chapter. The other great thing about this text, in my opinion, is that Arjuna is totally like us in so many different ways. Including, you know, there are times when we actually, you know, hopefully, where we actually do surrender ourselves to something larger, to something bigger than ourselves, to something bigger than the ego, and just like Arjuna does. But then Arjuna doesn't really get it. You know, Krishna keeps teaching him, like for at least 10 chapters, over and over again, teaching him different stuff. And Arjuna, like at the end of the chapter, goes, huh? Yeah, could you explain that differently somehow? Could you Could you make that a little easier for me to understand? And then Kristen tries it again. And it's not actually until the 11th chapter, next Saturday night for you guys, where Arjuna completely shuts up. And he shuts up in the face of like this epiphany, this mystical vision that he sees. He is awestruck and therefore dumbstruck. But until the 11th chapter, he's not dumbstruck yet. You know, keeps like, what about this? What about that? I don't get it. You know, you're a bad teacher. You haven't taught me right. You haven't, you know, taught me clearly enough. You know, so Krishna is a very patient teacher. And he tries it over and over and over again, as you know, as you'll see if you ever read the text from start to finish. You know, it's kind of like that. All right, so that's the setup. That's the beginning of the second chapter. Then the first thing that Krishna teaches is the yoga of wisdom. The first he goes directly into the deep end with Arjuna. Okay. The other thing about Arjuna, as I kind of suggested here before, Arjuna is not the sharpest tool in the shed, okay? You know, just like all of us, he's kind of a little slow, you know, slow on the draw. But, you know, so it's kind of odd. Krishna just throws him into the, like, deepest end of philosophy, the deepest end of wisdom. So here's an example here. The first yoga, in other words, the yoga of wisdom. You have mourned those who need not to be mourned, speaking words which only seem to be wise. You know, the words that he's been speaking, it's not correct to go and kill my relatives. You know, and so that does seem to be wise, right? It seems to be the correct viewpoint that's a bad thing to do. So Kirsten here says, you're mourning for those that need no mourning. Your words only seem to be wise. The learned, the pundits, the word in Sanskrit, pandita, pundit is a Sanskrit word. The learned do not grieve for neither the dead nor the living. So what's he saying here, actually? He's saying, take the big picture. Look at the big picture here. Stop, like, obsessing about your little, you know, relatively small little problems in life. Take the big pan out. I remember a cartoon I saw in one of the Australian papers, Melbourne hosted an international conference for professional atheists a couple of years ago. And so all of these, like, you know, sort of celebrity atheists came over, you know, Dawkins and all those guys. They came over to Melbourne. And so one of our great cartoonists for the paper here had a cartoon of the Earth, you know, from an outer space point of view, tiny little ball, tiny little planet, and then a tiny little, you know, pinpoint to Melbourne with tiny little letters going, the International Atheist Association convention meets here. You know, tiny little thing going on in the midst of this vast, you know, unknowable cosmos. So, yeah, it was great. So that's what he's doing. He's first telling Arjuna, like, you know, look at the big picture. There was never a time when I, you, or these lords mean like all the other, you know, warriors around. There was never a time when we were not. And there will never be a time in the future when we will all cease to be. Don't be taken in by the mere appearances of things. The mere appearances of things is things arise, they last for a while, and then they dissipate and die. Only to be, you know, rise again in some other form, last for a while, dissipate and die, over and over and over again. That's the way of the world. That's the way, every moment is like that. Every moment starts, lasts for a while, and then ends. And then a new moment comes. And our lives are like that too. According to the spiritual traditions, our lives are like that too. You know, we're little blips on the screen. We're born, we live for a while. We have all kinds of problems when we live, while we're living for a little while. And then we obsess about them. We say, oh my God, you know, I can't pay the rent. Or, oh my God, I just lost my job. Or, oh my God, I just got divorced. As if it was like the end of the world. And that's how we feel about it, isn't it? That's how we feel about our problems. And so Krishna here is just saying, take a big breath here. Look at the big picture. You know, stop obsessing about it. What's that slogan? Don't sweat the small stuff and it's all small stuff. You know, comparatively to the big picture of the universe, of the cosmos and eternity and all of that, you know, it's just a little blip on the screen. Don't worry. Next verse. What isn't truly real cannot come into existence, and what is truly real cannot go out of existence. The ultimate truth of both of these is surely seen by those who have seen how things really are. So what isn't truly real? What isn't true? Asat, asat, sat means real, asat means not real. So what isn't truly real? Well, everything that's changing isn't truly real. Everything that's changing isn't truly real. Why? Because it's there one moment and not there the next moment. Right? That's what change is. And we're very much like that, aren't we? Our individual selves. We're here for a while and then we're not here. Your personality, by the way, I mean, you know, if you've come to a spiritual tradition with the idea that you say your name to yourself will gain eternal life, you're going to be so sorely disappointed. You know, the individual has no eternal life. The soul may have eternal life. The spirit may have eternal life. The Buddha nature, whatever you want to call it. But that's not you. That's not the individual personality. That's not the ego. And I always thought, like, you know, there is a kind of a temptation. There's a kind of an allure to hope that I personally could live forever somehow. But if you think like for about 2 minutes on what that would be like, it'd be a nightmare. It would be like a bad science fiction movie where, you know, you, suffering schmuck, would never die, would never end. You would just eternally have the same like limitations and problems and, you know, bad personality and stuff like that that you have now. Who wants that? You know, so fortunately you're not going to get it. Fortunately, you say your name to yourself will definitely die, okay? Definitely. And then something else may or may not arise. And then there is something that does not die. What is truly real cannot go out of existence. And he's not just talking about like something other than you. The deeper nature of our being is eternal. The deeper nature of our being, and different traditions have different names for this. The soul, the immortal soul, you know, the infinite spirit, Buddha nature, the self with a capital S, the cosmic self or something like that. But there is a part of us. All the spiritual traditions agree that there is something that we are that is eternal. Our deeper nature, our deeper and true being. So this is what he's telling Arjuna. So the deeper nature of you and everyone here on the battlefield has never been born and will never die, cannot be killed, cannot be injured, is not changing. See? So, you know, this is something you might want to put in your pipe and smoke for a while. When it says, like, what isn't truly real versus what is truly real. What isn't truly real means everything that's changing isn't truly real. Because it's changing, you see? Because it's change. It can't be real. It's momentary, right? It comes into existence, lasts for a while, and goes out of existence. It's not really real. It's like a movie. It's like, you know, the frames of a movie, and you put those frames together and it seems like there's continuity and stuff like that, but it's just like individual frames of changing time. And that can't be truly real. And then, well, so what is truly real? Where is the eternal? And again, you could say this is the purpose of a spiritual life. The purpose of a spiritual life is to get in touch with the eternal. I had a professor in graduate school, Mircea Eliade, who was very famous in his time, a historian of religion, comparative religion. And he used to talk about religious people, homo religiosus, the religious person, as someone who has a terror of history, terror of time, of change, and wants to find that which does not change. So it tries to find that which is eternal. Because that which is not eternal is constantly changing. And there's nothing to hold on to. No security there. No stability there. And the Buddhists, of course, say the same thing in different language. Not that different, you know. That samsara, that we suffer because we grasp to change. We grasp to things that are changing. And you can't grasp to them. They will disappoint you. So you can think about, well, what is it in your life that's changing? And, you know, are your relationships changing? Is your, you know, economic situation changing? Is your job a changing thing or an unchanging? Are your possessions changing or unchanging? And if you're grasping on to changing things as if they wouldn't change, you are guaranteed to suffer. Guaranteed to suffer when they show you their true nature, which is that they change. Relationships don't last forever. Relationships certainly don't stay static. You know, your economic situation has its ups and downs. Your job is sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant. You know, everything in our lives, our ordinary lives, is change. It's just change. And we can't stop or arrest change. And it can't be arrested like that. So the spiritual quest is to accept change. You know, accept change as the way it is in the world, as the way it is in this messy world that we live in. To accept it and embrace it and not be surprised by it. And also to try to find what doesn't change. To try to get in touch with the eternal, the real. And you can call that God. I'm going to use the G word in these teachings kind of a lot. I don't care. I know that people give some people the willies, you know, to hear, oh, God, you know. I came to this group, this Buddhist group, because I, you know, I don't believe in God. And, well, here's God, you know, okay? Everyone believes in God. I actually think this. Everyone believes in God. They don't. It's just a name. You see, that G-O-D is just a name. But everyone who's not living a kind of bleak, suicidal life has some faith in something that, you know, that's bigger. You can call it nature. You can call it the universe. You know, sometimes people say, oh, the universe has given me a parking spot here downtown. You know, what the hell? What is that except for God? People believe in Buddha, you know, as if Buddha was different than God. You know, come on. It's just names. These are just names. They're names for God. And God is the name that I grew up with, actually, for that which cannot be named, for that which has no name, for that which cannot be captured into words. That God was the word that I heard growing up. And so in my old age, I've come back to it. Unabashedly, unashamedly, you know, to talk about God. And so I'll be doing that here, whether you like it or not. All right. So that's the first yoga, the yoga of wisdom. Then here's a little summary of the second yoga. No action in this world goes for naught or brings about a contrary result. This is a statement of the law of karma. You know, kind of like a familiar phrase in the Western world now. So the law of karma, you know, can be stated as simply as this. No action in the world goes for naught. Nothing just disappears into the vapor. Nothing just evaporates. Every action has a reaction. Everything you say has a reaction, has some kind of effect on the world. Everything you think also, every thought you think has a consequence. Okay? Everything has a consequence, you could say. That's the first law of karma. Then the second one, or brings about a contrary result. Nothing bad can come from something good, and nothing good can come from something bad. And if you don't have those two, you know, that's a summary of the law of karma, but you can also say that's a summary of any ethical system. Every ethical system, no matter what you call it, karma or not, has to have those two components. Nothing is just random. Nothing goes for naught means like nothing just you know that there is there are consequences. There are consequences to what we do. And if you don't think that there are consequences to what we do, then you have no ethical system at all. And if you think that well, there may be consequences, but sometimes bad things happen because of something good I did. Then you don't have any ethical system at all either. You don't have a system. Then it's just random. Well, bad things can come from good. Good things can come from good. Who knows? It's just the luck of the draw or something like that. So here the karma yoga, the discipline of action, begins with understanding the law of karma. That nothing goes for naught, and there can be nothing good coming from bad or nothing bad coming from good. Even the smallest religious practice protects against great fear. Even the smallest kind of moral, understanding can protect you from really bad consequences, So we all do our best here, We try to do what's right, and sometimes we think, well, I can't do completely the right thing. I can only do an approximation of the right thing. And Krishna's saying, well, that's better than nothing. not even the smallest sort of, kind of dharma, the kind of correct action, true action, real action. Not even the smallest goes to waste. So, this is good news, I think, for those of us living in this messy world with an imperfect understanding and ability to do what we, know is right. So just do the best you can. The best you can will have positive consequences. Not everything has to be done perfectly in order for it to be good. You see what I mean? So not even the smallest religious practice protects, against great fear. Your prerogative is over your actions. You have power over what you do. What you do, say, or think. Not over the results. Not over any of the results. So now we get into the finer points of karma yoga. He says, stop worrying about the consequences. Stop worrying about the effects. There will be consequences. There will be effects. He stated it in the law of karma. Nothing good can come from something bad. Nothing bad can come from something good. But don't do good in order to get good. You see? Do good because it's the right thing to do. Don't do it for what you're going to get out of it. And this is a little harder, isn't it? It's hard enough to do good. It's hard enough to do the right thing sometimes. But then we want to get paid back. You say, well, look, I did the right thing, so I should be rewarded. Right? We do good in order to be rewarded. And Krishna's saying, well, that's not really good. If you're doing good in order to be rewarded, it's not really good. That's that phrase, virtue is its own reward. It's only virtue if it's its own reward. If you're thinking about the reward that you're going to get by living a virtuous life, it's not really virtuous. You see what I mean? So give up the attachment to the results of action. Give up the attachment to what am I going to get out of it. Do not let the results be the motivation of action. But do not be attached to inaction either. Do it. Do your job. Do what you need to do in life. Don't be attached to inaction. But don't be motivated by personal gain in your actions. Surrender the fruits of actions. That's karma yoga. Do your duty. Do what there is to do. Do it the best you can. Do it with the best understanding of what right is, right and wrong are. But stop doing it for what you're personally going to get out of it. Surrender your actions to something larger than you. So what could that? There's lots of things that are larger than us. Surrender your actions to your nation. Surrender your actions to your family. Surrender your actions to your community. Surrender your actions to God. But surrender your actions to something bigger than just your individual ego and what it's going to get out of it. So this is the opposite, by the way. The opposite of of surrendering is attachment. Is clinging, is grasping. And these words should have reverberations for those of you who have studied Buddhism. This is the problem. The problem in Buddhism, the reason that we suffer is because of grasping. attachment and so forth. So Krishna is not teaching a non-Buddhist thing here. Be unattached to the results of your action. Do your actions well. Do your actions to your best of your ability, but without the attachment to the consequences or results. What am I going to get out of it personally? Giving up attachment, perform actions as a practice of yoga, Arjuna. So have discipline in your actions. Be the same whether you are successful or unsuccessful. So you do something and it turns out well. Don't get too high about it. And then you do something and it doesn't turn out so well. Don't get all depressed about it. Be the same means equanimous. Be chilled out. You know, you did your best, okay? If you do your best in whatever it is, and you know, with the difficulty with kids at home or, you know, some problem you're having at work, do your best and then let go of whether it's going to be successful or not. Because you know what? You can only do your best, right? If you're doing your best, that's the best you can do. So do your best and relax, okay? And only you, of course, know what your best is, okay? But in a way, you could say we're all kind of doing our best all the time. Well, you know, we're doing our best. So do your best and then chill out about the ramifications, you know, the apparent ramifications, with the understanding, of course, that nothing bad can come from something good and nothing good can come from something bad. And primarily this means your intention. If your intention is good, which means selfless, which means altruistic, which means compassionate, which means loving, if your intention is good, then a good consequence must come. It may not come immediately. It probably won't come immediately. It may not come in the package that you thought it would come. But it will come. Have some faith, okay? That's a law. That's the law of karma. And if you don't have that, you know, you're just adrift. You're just adrift in the world with no rudder, no navigation system, no GPS at all. So the law of karma gives us GPS. But Krishna is also saying, but don't obsess about what kind of fruit you're going to get out of your action and what that fruit's going to look like, what the consequence is going to be. Don't obsess about you all the time and what you're going to get out of the deal. Do the right thing. Like Spike Lee said in that movie, do the right thing. Do the right thing and don't worry about like what happens. Okay? It's not in your control in a way. Okay? The consequences are not in your immediate control. They're bigger than you. If you think about the law, if you think of that, if you work out the ramifications of causality, cause and effect, they're mind-blowing. You know, every effect is brought to us by by an infinite number of causes that contributed to that effect. You can't figure it out. It's beyond you. It's beyond us to figure out the exact workings of what we call karma in the Eastern traditions. So don't worry about it. Do the right thing, okay? Karma is for real. Okay? Karma does work. But it can't work in a way that you can understand it. Yeah, let alone manipulate it, okay? You know? We all want to sort of find tools to get what it is we want in life. So, you know, we get skills, you know, we go to college or we go to like trade school, we get some skills in order to get what we want out of life economically or professionally or something like that. And then we come to the spiritual tradition and we look for those same tools. We look for a tool like karma, which, you know, will guarantee that we will get what we personally want out of life, what we think we want out of life. And that's a wrong-headed approach to the spiritual life. The purpose of a spiritual life is not to get you what you want, what you personally want. It's to get you to contentment, to not wanting at all anymore, to being happy with your life no matter what happens, whether you're successful or unsuccessful. This equanimity is what's called yoga. You can put that on a Lululemon t-shirt. You know, yoga isn't about like being all twisty and bendy and having a better yoga butt than somebody else. Yoga is equanimity, is being able to be chilled out whether things are going right or wrong for you, okay? To have an even keel, you know that term? An even keel as you sail through life. A pure action is said to be one which is obligatory. Niyata in Sanskrit. Niyata means you must do it. So if you're a mother or a father, you have an obligation to your children. If you're a, you know, if you have bills, you have an obligation to figure out how to pay them. You see, we have obligations in life. We have responsibilities. So a pure action is one in which you are fulfilling your responsibilities, but it's done without attachment, without wanting to obtain a result, and without desire or aversion, raga or dvesha. Without, you know, I didn't want this job, dvesha, you know, aversion, or, oh, I love this job and I want to keep it forever, you know, desire. This is what you have to do now. This is your life now. We all, you know, I was thinking about this earlier. The older you get, I think, in life, the more you realize that, you're not directing the events of your life. Your life unfolds in ways that, you know, that just present events to you, you see? So, you know, if you get pregnant, you know, that's an event that has presented itself to you. And I guess nowadays you can have a choice. You can get an abortion, or you can spend, you know, the rest of your life with the consequences of that event. You see, that event changes your life. It changes the directory, the direction of your life. There's lots of things like this, you know. Lots of events that just arise in our lives, and then we have to deal with them. We have to change our course, the idea of the way we wanted our lives to go, in response to the events that life throws at us. And so without desire or aversion, without like complaining, oh, this happened and now my life is ruined, or this happened and, you know, and I wanted something else to happen, and so now my life is different than what I thought it would be. Well, of course your life is different than what you thought it would be. You know, did you think 5 years ago that your life would be the way it is now? So you can't predict it. You know, you can't predict the direction of your life. But you can accept it or not accept it. And most of us are living in non-acceptance. We're living our lives in non-acceptance, thinking that, well, you know, if only this were different, or if only I didn't have this, you know, nasty partner, if only I had a better job, or if only, you see, living life as if only, instead of by the, you know, kind of reality principle. It's like this now. You heard that mantra ever? It's like this now. And so, you know, what's the point of not accepting it? It's not, you're not accepting the way things are aren't going to make them different than the way things are. You see, your non-acceptance isn't going to change them. So, you know, you might as well accept it. You might as well be equanimous about it. Not wanting to obtain a result and without desire or aversion. It's better to do one's own duty imperfectly than another's well. This is a very famous verse from the Bhagavad Gita. It's so famous, or it's so important actually, that Krishna says it twice in almost the same language, in different parts of the text. It's better to do what you have to do than sitting around wishing what about somebody else's life, and maybe even trying to mimic it. Trying to, you know, pretend that you're somebody else. You know, like if you're born in Tennessee, don't like sit around thinking, oh, I wish I were an Eskimo. You know? And in fact, I'm going to try to live a really, really Eskimo-like life. You know, I'm going to build an igloo in the backyard, well, you know, under artificial circumstances this time of year probably, and, you know, and dress up as an igloo, as an Eskimo, and try to learn how to fish with spearing fish and eat whale blubber. You know, be who you are. This is the life that you've been born into. This is the life that you have. Try. It's better to accept and do your best, even imperfectly, with the life that you have, than to try to be inauthentic in a kind of a perfect way. That's kind of what he's saying. Than to do another person's duty well, to be an inauthentic person trying to mimic the life of somebody else, rather than to, you know, accept your own life and live it the best you can. There is no fault in doing the action which is necessitated by one's own nature. This is kind of a radical statement, actually. You know, there's no fault. There's no dosha in Sanskrit. Dosha means problem or fault or imperfection. In doing what it is that you have to do, necessitated by your own nature, is how your life is unfolding. So you live your life as it's unfolding. There's no fault in living whatever life we're living, okay? You just have to live it right. you have to deal with the messiness of life, the imperfection of your life, in the best way that you can, through yoga, through discipline of the three sorts. One should not abandon the action one is born to do. You know, I was thinking about this. This, of course, you can contextualize a text like this. It was written 2,000 years ago in caste India. And unfortunately, a lot of recourse has been made to this text to justify the caste system, you know, historically. So the caste system is one in which you are born into a particular, you know, social station. And you can't, you know, kind of just say, no, I didn't want to be an untouchable. I wanted to be a Brahmin. I wanted to be a, you know, high caste person. You know, you are what you are born into, class-wise, economically, socially, and so forth. So, you know, in one sense, that's what he's saying here in terms of the context. But given the fact that the Gita is a universally applicable, timeless text, we can think about it in terms of, you know, our own lives. One should not abandon the action one is born to do. You know, we're all born with a certain kind of capability, with certain kind of talents, certain genetic dispositions, certain predilections. And, you know, you shouldn't try to not be you. You are who you are. You know, we all kind of are born with the life that we then live out. You know? So accept yourself. This is like, you know, I was talking about psychology before. This is deep psychology. You know, accept who you are. Pimples and flaws and all, okay? And of course, the purpose of life is to try to improve yourself also. But you can't improve yourself unless you know who you are and have accepted yourself. You don't know what there is that needs improvement and what there is that needs, you know, further refinement. And, you know, there's, don't know what to give up and what to take up unless you know who's in there, what kind of personality you have. One should not abandon the action one is born to do, Arjuna, even when it's flawed. Even when, you know, there's difficulties. Even when it's not perfect, you know. Then this is a very radical, I think, next line here. All undertakings are flawed, like fire enveloped by smoke. We live in an imperfect world. And everything that we do is flawed. Even the best, you know, most spiritual, most moral, most ethical, most wise kind of actions that we can take are flawed because they're in a flawed world. You know, the actions themselves, you know, have consequences that we could never know. So, you know, our very lives are creating negative consequences all over the place, you know, all around the world. Look at the environment. Look at global warming. Look at the inequalities, economic inequalities and disparities that we live with in order to live the lives that we're living with, right? In order to live our very lives, it requires that other people live crappy lives, actually, okay? We're riding on the backs of the billions of unfortunate people and the very planet, you know, the exploitation of the very planet. So it's a messy world. It's effed up. Every action, all undertakings are flawed, like fire enveloped by smoke. So we can't perfect the actions. We can't like perfect the whole, you know, ball game. What we can perfect is ourselves and the way that we come into life, the way that we deal with life from the inner point of view. And so we do our best following yoga. We try to surrender. We try to surrender all the aspects of our selfish, egotistical, what about me nature. And then we do our best like that. Okay? So that's a little summary of the first two yogas. So I thought we'd spend just a few minutes here looking at the negative instead of the positive. Looking at the, you know, like the negative exposure of an old photograph. What does a non-spiritual life look like, actually? And there are verses here that are kind of pointing us to look at ourselves in the mirror a little bit, maybe. Because he's not talking about somebody else. You're not talking about those nasty people, you know, who didn't come to the Bhagavad Gita teachings, who out there, you know, partying in Nashville while we serious spiritual people here are being good. He's talking about all of us, okay? Deluded wrongdoers, the lowest of people, do not take themselves to me. I capitalized the pronoun here so that, you know who he's talking about here. Krishna's God. Don't take themselves to something bigger than themselves. Deprived of wisdom by the illusion, by Maya, they adhere to a demonic way of life. Pretty strong language. People whose wisdom has been carried off by their desires, by just wanting stuff all the time. What about me? What can I get? What's going to make me happy? What's going to satisfy, you know, my desire for endless pleasure and avoidance of things that aren't so pleasurable? People whose wisdom has been carried off by their desires, who are constrained by the limits of their own natures, take refuge in other deities. What other deities do you suppose he's talking about? He's not talking, this is not Krishna talking about Shiva and all those like losers who take themselves to Shiva. You know, come on, just names, just product, differentiation, same God. So what God is he talking about here? When I was growing up in Sunday school, you know, I heard this verse from the Bible. I didn't look up exactly where it is in the New Testament, where I think Jesus says, you know, you have to serve either God or Mammon. And I go like, who the hell's Mammon? You know, I never met anybody named Mammon. You know, I don't see any like first church to Mammon or anywhere like that. What is Mammon? And Mammon is shopping. Okay, Mammon is just wanting, you know, to please your endless cravings and desires all the time. So we serve all kinds of secular deities. We serve the deity of money, don't we? All of us do, okay? Some people, we point our fingers at some people who, you know, we think are more greedy or, you know, have more avarice than we do. But we're all greedy. We all serve money to some extent. We serve power. You know, we want to be important in whatever sort of realm of life you're in. We want status. We serve the deity of status, the god of status. We serve fame, especially nowadays, okay? Fame doesn't just mean like getting on the cover of People magazine. Fame means thumbs up on your Facebook page also, you know? And that's becoming like so important to us. How many people liked me? How many people put their thumbs up on my picture of my cat, you know? So we're all very much attracted to fame these days. That's a god. That's a deity. It's a pride. You know, we worship pride. We worship especially the self. We worship ourselves. And I mean our individual selves, our ego. So that's what it means to take refuge in other deities. To take refuge in all of those aspects of our selfishness, of our self-centeredness, of our need, our constant need and desire to further our own interests in all the ways that we do that. Today, so this is one of my favorite like riffs in the Bhagavad Gita. He's again talking about kind of the opposite of a spiritual person, an egocentrical person, a person who's just thinking that they're the boss. You know, I'm the king. I think there's a term in Tibetan, I forgot it now, the Tibetan actually, but the word for pride in Tibetan can be parsed into I am king, I'm the king. So this is the person who thinks they're the king. Today I've acquired this thing and now I will obtain that thing. Okay, this is the sort of stockbroker investor king, I guess. Today I've made this deal, you know, tomorrow I'll score again. Whatever I fancy, I'll obtain. All this money is mine. I'm a self-made man, right? Self-made woman. All this money is mine. I earned it through my own sweat and blah, 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 blah. And there will be plenty more coming in soon because I'm so capable. Yeah? I mean, that's the idea. It was I who single-handedly killed that enemy. Okay, this is a warrior speaking, right? So this is like some version of his pride. But we all have, you know, in whatever occupation, whatever sort of aspect of life, have this attitude too. I did it. I'm the one. We love to take responsibilities for, or take responsibility for our success. Not so good at taking responsibility for our failures, but we love to take responsibility for our successes. I did this. And again, you can bring that right into the spiritual life. You can say, oh, you know, I created the karma for this awesome job that I just got. Like, you know, the whole complicated, you know, virtually infinite chain of cause and effect that led you to get the job that you got. I created the karma. It was I who single-handedly killed that enemy, and I'll kill lots of others in the future. I am the master of my destiny. Sound familiar? I mean, you know, we all have this inner voice. I am the master of my destiny. I am the enjoyer. I am successful, strong, and happy. A lot of first-person pronouns there. I. I am rich and well-born. Who is equal to me? It is I who will sponsor sacrifices. I will give. I will rejoice. So this is spiritual pride he's talking about here. I'm the awesomest in the Sangha. I'm the best meditator. You know, I'm much better at ethics than these other slobs around here. So say those deluded by ignorance, bewildered by ceaseless mental chatter. Aneka chitta. Aneka means not one. Chitta means mind. Your mind is all just dispersed around. Ceaseless mental chatter, enveloped in the web of delusion, addicted to the gratification of desires, they fall into a stinking hell. Conceited and stubborn, filled with the arrogance and pride that comes from wealth. This is a very interesting kind of turn of phrase here. All of us who are fortunate enough to have wealth have some arrogance and pride about it. We somehow think that it's our God-given right to have it. And, you know, there are billions of people living on $2 a day, $3 a day, you know, and we just think, well, that's unfortunate, but somehow we have the right to our money, to our prosperity, that's our right somehow. This is, I think, in the American Constitution, isn't it? The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have that individual right. So he's like, there's a kind of an arrogance and pride that comes automatically with prosperity. Automatically. They offer religious rituals in name only. Again, talking about spiritual pride. Hypocritically and disregarding proper decorum. Resorting to egoism. I'll just tell you what the word is in Sanskrit. It's a very interesting word. Ahamkara. Aham. Aham means I. It's the first person pronoun. And kara means maker. The eye maker, ahamkara, is the ego. Resorting to egoism, power, conceit, desire, and anger, these malicious people hate me. They hate the divine. They hate what's bigger than themselves. They hate God. And now, check this out. Whether it is the me that is in their own bodies or who is embodied in others, where is God? Who is Krishna? Where is the divine? So, you know, here he's saying the divine is in each and every one of us. And we, the ego hates the divine part of ourselves. The ego sort of overshadows, the egotistical self overshadows our divine nature. So we hate the me, the Krishna, or the God that's in ourselves, or who is embodied in others. All right. So, now we'll start talking about the third yoga directly, okay? The yoga of devotion. Bhakti yoga. So I've called this section the bridge to bhakti, the bridge to devotion, because it's also kind of a version of the second yoga, of karma yoga, of how to act in the world. The term is sacrificial action. Yajna in Sanskrit. Yajna is a term that they used to use for the fire sacrifices in the most ancient period of Indian religion, where they would build big fires and offer all kinds of stuff into the fires, including animals, by the way, including possibly humans. But anyway, that's probably the oldest known religion in India, yajna, sacrifice. And then sacrifice sort of put its kind of stamp on the development of religion in India subsequently. So he's using a very loaded term here when he's saying sacrifice. You do your action as a sacrifice. The basic ideology of sacrifice is that you give up something or all of yourself in order to get back something bigger than yourself. All offerings of sacrifice are symbols of the self, of sacrificing of the self. Maybe you guys remember being in the Bible Belt and all, studying the Old Testament and the story of Abraham and Isaac, where God tells Abraham, you know, give me your son, sacrifice your son to me. And of course the son, you know, in patriarchal history was as close as you could get to yourself without it being yourself. So you see what I mean? It's like the closest symbol to the self. But all offerings are offerings of something of the self, if not all of the self. So this is a kind of it's an interesting word. The sacrifice of self-interest, the sacrifice of selfishness, the sacrifice of the egocentric life is sacrificial action. And dedication to something bigger than yourself. Everyone in this world is bound by karmic, by actions, by karma, unless they are done as sacrifices. So, you know, in Indian traditions, Hinduism and Buddhism, yoga traditions alike, karma is the problem. Karma binds us. Karma keeps us in the world of suffering, in the cycle of samsara, over and over and over again. So if that's the problem, then what's the solution? How do I get out of karma? How do I get out of the endless cycle of cause and effect, of action and consequence to action? So he's saying here, well, all actions are going to involve that unless they're done as sacrifices, unless they're done selflessly. The essence of karma is selfishness, okay? The essence of karma is the I that creates an action and hopes for a result. The essence of karma is intention, you can say. And there has to be an intender for there to be intention. I want something out of this deal, you see? So how can we escape the endless cycle of cause and effect, of karma and consequence, of action and consequence? He said, well, do it selflessly. Do it like a sacrifice. So perform action with that as the purpose, Arjuna, freed from attachment to the results of action. The karma of one who is without attachment and free, whose mind is stabilized in wisdom, and whose actions are sacrificial, completely dissolve. How do you dissolve karma? Well, live your life sacrificially. Live your life for some higher thing, for some higher purpose than just the individual ego. The one who knows me to be the recipient of all sacrifices and austerities, the great Lord of all the worlds and the friend of all beings, will attain peace. So no matter what it is that you think you're sacrificing to or for, whether you call it the nation state, United States of America, where you call it your family, whether you call it, you know, the universe, whether you call it the Buddha, I will give all my actions to the Buddha, whether you call it the Guru, it's all to God. These are all versions of God. Doesn't matter what you call them, doesn't matter how you conceptualize them. What you are sacrificing to, what you are acting for, is something transcendent of the individual. So Krishna here, speaking as God with a capital G, says, well, you know, there's lots of other gods. There's lots of lesser gods. There's lots of deities that people are devoted to. But these are all versions of devotion to the one God, to the God. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you sacrifice, whatever you give, whatever kind of austerities you perform, dieting, for example, is an austerity, do that as an offering to me. Do everything in life as a sacrifice to God. So this is a combination now of karma yoga and bhakti yoga, of how to act in the world without getting entrapped in the endless consequences of action. You see, how to act and be free, how to be free of karma. It says, well, stop doing stuff for yourself. Do it for something bigger than yourself. Do it for God, whatever it is. Whatever you eat. So, you know, like if you were brought up in a, you know, household like I was, we were taught to say prayers before we ate. Like before we ate anything. And, you know, that's a way of reminding yourself, well, my life, this food, this dinner, wasn't just made by me. that my life, my world, the food in front of me comes from something bigger than me. I belong to a bigger whole. And, you know, that's kind of that meal prayer, isn't it? God is great, God is good, and we thank Him for our food, you know. So whatever you do, whatever, so you have a task to do at work. You know, don't do it for your own aggrandizement, self-aggrandizement, for, you know, whether the boss will be happy and give you a promotion. Offer it up to God. Do it for God. Living in God, I think they call it in the Christian tradition, right? Living in God. So, in a sense, you could say we all live in God. We're always living in God. We're always living in a world, in a universe that we don't understand, that's way bigger than us. So, have a little consciousness about that. And throughout your daily life, no matter what you're doing, offer your actions up to God as a sacrifice. You will in this way be freed from the bonds of karma and from pleasant or unpleasant results. Liberated and practiced in the yoga of renunciation. Renunciation of what? Of self-interest. Of what it is that you're going to get out of the deal. If you practice in the yoga of renunciation, you shall reach me. You shall reach God. So this is a phrase that occurs over and over again in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, if you give up your ego, if you give up your selfishness, your self-centeredness, you will reach God. You will reach me. So what does it mean to reach me? What does it mean to reach God? And, you know, in the Buddhist text they say it means two things. It means that you will see God. That you will see God all around you. That you will see your life as made possible by God. You will see other people as the expressions of God. You will see events as the manifestation of God. You will see God. You will reach God in the sense that you will see God. And then secondly, you will reach God in that you will know that you are not different than God. It's not God and then you. That our deepest nature, our true self, our eternal soul is not the individual self. It is the cosmic self. It is the universal self. It is God. We are God. And you know, you say that kind of thing in the Western traditions, traditionally, historically, they start like collecting kindling for the fire, you know? They can burn you at the stake by going around saying, I am God. But in Eastern traditions, this is a regular thing. They say it all the time. Our deepest nature, our true self, is not different than God. So, we'll come back to this over and over again. I wanted to hear from you guys. Well, I wanted to keep this a little bit interactive, and I went on longer than I wanted to already. But I think you can think about devotion in three ways. Three levels, you could say. Three levels of devotion to the divine. However you understand the divine, okay? If you don't like me saying God, well, just like translate that into whatever works for you. The cosmos, the universe, you know, nature. Most people understand nature in the same way as other people understand what they call God. Something bigger than you, okay? Something transcendent of the individual self. So you can say there's three levels to it. The first level of devotion is seeing God outside of you. Seeing God in the world outside of you. Seeing God in a sunset. You ever seen like a like totally incredible sunset? You know, and if you're just really deaf to you know, spirituality as a whole, you know, you probably just sit there and like analyze it. You probably just sit there and go, well, this is the light has refracted in such and such a way with these kinds of like freaking molecules in the air, and you just like do some scientific reduction of the experience. But if you have any kind of spiritual sensibility, you know, it's awesome. And you sit there with your mind blown, okay? And so you see God outside of yourself. You see God in nature. You see God in maybe in certain kind of miraculous events that occur. I think most people have had these events occur. I'm more and more convinced, talking to people and thinking about my own life, miracles are happening all the time. Miracles happen to us all the time, and then we just go, oh, whatever. You know, we sit there, we go, oh, wow, and we go, huh, oh, whatever, and we get on with it without, like, realizing that this was a total freaking miracle that just happened. So seeing God outside yourself, first level. Second level, seeing God within. Seeing that there is part of our very being, our very nature, the deepest part, that is the divine. And this is kind of like the ultimate, what do you call it, affirmation. The ultimate self-affirmation is I am God. And it's not you say your name to yourself that's God. Oh my God, what a mistake that would be, so to speak. It's not you, you know, David, or me, you know, Marut, who's God. It's not our personal, individual personality. But it's something deep in us. It is the nobody self, as I call it in my book, in one of my books. It's the self that's nobody. It's not somebody. If you're somebody, you're particularized, you're individualized. But it's that sense of being nobody, which is everybody. That self. So that's the second level. The devotion to the God that's within you. And then the third level, which they say is the highest level, the culmination of devotion. The culmination of the path of devotion. Which again we'll talk much more about, like what that path involves in subsequent classes. But the third level is seeing God both in yourself and outside yourself as omnipresent within and without. And that's the highest level of bhakti. There's nothing that is not God. There's a joke, I'll just tell you one joke quickly and then we can have a little discussion. There was a joke about a Zen Buddhist practitioner who wandered into a Buddhist temple. And he goes up to the statue of the Buddha, the main big gold statue of the Buddha, and he pulls down his trousers and he pisses on it. And the temple priest comes running out and goes, "What the hell are you doing? You're pissing on the Buddha." And the Zen guy says, "Show me a place I can piss where there isn't a Buddha. Show me where I can piss where the Buddha is not." And that's understanding. That third level. There's no place outside of yourself that you can piss where there's no Buddha. And you can't piss inside yourself either where there's no Buddha. So I guess that's a really good place to end what I have to say formally. So please, let's have some discussion, questions. Do you understand what he's talking about when he's talking about sacrificial action? I have with each one of these classes an exercise. So if you turn your page from the last bit that we were just going over in the Sanskrit, the exercise for class one here, which you can do between now and tomorrow, or you can do all during the week, actually, between this. I prefer to have these exercises done for a whole week so you get some juice out of them. But reflect on the concept of sacrificial action. To what or to whom do you presently sacrifice at least some of your time, energy, and activity? And we all do, right? We sacrifice to our family. We sacrifice our time to our work. We sacrifice, you know, all kinds of things of our egotistical, you know, kind of inclinations. We give those up to something that we regard as more important. So to think of that, once you've identified this, make it a practice to be more conscious when you engage in sacrificial action. And try to fully renounce any selfish motivation and completely dedicate the fruits of this action. Dedicate the fruits of this action means I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for the well-being or welfare of something or someone bigger than me, or more important than me, other than me at least. So good for family life, I think, especially. Like, you know, if you've got kids especially, you're going to have to sacrifice your time to them, you know, whether you kind of want to or not. So better to try to do that consciously and happily than to do it reluctantly and unappreciatively. Like, oh, geez, I got to, like, make the dinner for the family again. Or, you know, I really wish I was, you know, watching reality television instead of doing that. You know, give it up. Give up your selfishness to serve something or someone other than yourself and be a little more conscious about it. That's sacrificial action. That's what Krishna's talking about. So that's a little exercise if you wanted to try to, you know, kind of put some of this teaching into practice into your own life. Okay. Up to you guys now.
Thank you. Awesome beginning. Really looking forward to the week. I'll just start kind of the questions and thoughts, and then please, anybody, if you have me asking, he's here for that. But I just wanted to say, in this last passage that you were just discussing, the 927, I was very much reminded of the Christian communion, where Jesus takes the simplest action of bread and wine and says, "Do this in remembrance of me," in the context of the largest sacrifice. Whatever you do, this in remembrance of me. Same thing.
Absolutely. The Christian tradition as a whole is totally centered around the concept of sacrifice. This, of course, is what made Jesus the Christ. He sacrificed himself. He sacrificed his whole body on the cross. He gave himself up. The Christian tradition is wholly centered around the concept of sacrifice.
I think it's nice that he's saying, you're not all going to do this cross thing.
Yeah, right.
Even when you just take a piece of bread, you can do a sacrifice.
Yeah, in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, there's a similar kind of a concept. He said, how to live an altruistic, selfless life. He says, start by giving away vegetables. You know, give away the carrots that you grew up back in the veggie garden to a neighbor, and eventually you'll work your way up to being able to give away your own body. But you don't start with your own body. You gotta work your way up to that.
Thank you.
Ryan.
Recently I've been trying to redo, because I never actually finished it. Yeah, 30 days of dedication where you kind of just dedicate. And the more I've been like thinking about it, the more I've been doing it, it's really hard for me not to put the I and focus on the fruits. Because I did this in honor of you, and the fruits that I don't want the fruits, I want to give you the fruits. But you're still kind of focusing on the I, and I'm having problems not focusing on the I and the fruits when they can dedicate somebody else.
Well, join the club.
Were you able to hear about some of that?
Yeah, I heard the whole
problem is removing the self out of the dedication, even when you're dedicated.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, I mean, like I said, join the club. I mean, this is the whole thing. I mean, this is the... If it were easy, it wouldn't be a yoga. It wouldn't be a discipline. The fact that you're conscious of how difficult it is a start, is a major start, actually, of being able to watch the mind and see, like, how self-centered the mind is. Even when you're trying to do, like, the best possible thing you can, you know, think you can do, like trying to really serve other people, or trying to really live a good life, a selfless life, trying to really, you know, cultivate your spiritual practice, you see the I get involved all over the place. I think this is one of the things that Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was pointing to, who, for those of you who don't know, was one of the great Tibetan Buddhist teachers of, I think, the last century. anyway, he's pointing to this self-interest that infects pretty much everything that we do, including our spiritual lives, in the term spiritual materialism. So even in our spiritual practices, we want to get something from them. Yeah, we want to be happier. We want to be more successful. We want to have, you know, people like us. We, you know, want to avoid, you know, difficulties, financial difficulties, and so we do our spiritual practice in the hopes that we will get something out of it. And so I think we have to take it incrementally. You know, we have to say, like, well, that's a good place to start. Is that you want to live a happier life? You want to be sort of enlightened in your self-interest? Well, start living a good life. Start trying to be a better person. Start trying to be more honest with people. Start trying to be less greedy. Stop trying to hurt people all the time, and that will make you happier. Live a happier, better life. That's a good place to start. But you know, that's not the end. That's not the end of a spiritual life. That's the beginning. The thing that the spiritual life is trying to teach us at its lowest level is to bring us to its highest level. So what is it teaching us at the lowest level? Well, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. That's kind of basic, okay? That's foundational. But what is it pointing to? Well, it's pointing to the fact that we're all alike, that I'm not special somehow, that I'm not different. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, think about yourself in a more expansive way. And that's a sort of a different level, isn't it? That's a different level of understanding the self, of your own identity. So you're connecting, you know, your sense of self to a larger understanding of the self, to a more communal understanding of the self. Love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, and then even higher than that, I think, is understanding that at our deepest level, you know, we're not like others; we are others. That there is no true distinction between things that are all interconnected, things and beings that are all interconnected. So this is a long-winded answer to your question, Ryan. Of course it's difficult to get the I out of the way. That's the whole project. And as we're moving towards, you know, a deeper understanding of who you really are, try to be good to the I. Try to be good to the individual self by doing the kinds of things that our spiritual traditions have taught us will make us live happier, more successful, rewarding lives. You know, in terms of our own sense of happiness and acceptance, our own sense of contentment with who we are. So, it's a hierarchy. It's a ladder. We climb the steps one at a time. Yep. It's really good that you recognize it. It's really good that you recognize how omnipresent selfishness is. Omnipresent. All the time. Me, 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 me. That's the start, though. To recognize it is the start to try to figure out ways to overcome it. The other thing I would say here is also to recognize that is precisely why we are unhappy. You know, it's not that the I hasn't been rewarded enough, or hasn't been like propped up enough, or hasn't been recognized by others as being awesome enough. It's the fact that it's insatiable. That the ego will never have enough. There will never be enough thumbs up, okay? You always want a couple of more. There'll never be enough, like, you know, food for the insatiable hunger of the ego. And so then to have some recognition, well, the attempt to try to always feed it is futile. You know, it's a dead end. And so we can pay more attention to methods that will really pay off for us instead of following false false leads and going down paths that most of us have, you know, most people spend their whole lives going down, you know. The if only path. If only I had, you know, enough money. If only I had, you know, this or that. If only I had a cabin in the woods. If only, and, you know, and then they die. Chanting if only. Mumbling if only. If only I had another 5 minutes to live. If only. And so the if only path just leads to more if onlys. And so recognizing that's extremely important to then try to start to redistribute what energy we have for a practice that's really going to pay off for us, and start, you know, among other things, start concentrating your efforts and your energies on contentment with what you have, with who you are, with the people around you, with the situation around you, instead of always like wanting something else, wanting it to be different. You see, because that's the basic project of the ego, is to always want it to be different, better. So it's, you know, the beginning of contentment is realizing it's good enough now. Doesn't need to be better. Good enough now. And, you know, I know it's hard to do. Of course it's hard to do. But in my experience, it helps to kind of do a little comparison shopping and to sort of realize, like, how many lives are so much worse than the lives that we're leading here and now. You know. So what are we really complaining about all the time? All the material needs are certainly taken care of. All the needs for shelter, for, you know, for heat, for coolness, for food, for, you know, clothing, all the material needs are long, long ago taken care of, you know. So what is it that we're so dissatisfied with? And you know, I think I don't have enough somehow. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough friends. I don't have enough recognition. I don't have enough, you know, position in my career or something like that. And so that's the other mantra that I've been teaching for years. Say Om. Everyone has to say it. Om.
I have
enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you do.
I'm swinging, by the way, due to this group.
Hello.
First, EJ, thanks to you. It's lovely. Okay, here. Enough of me. Here. So a minute ago, I think I heard, maybe I misheard it, but I heard we also need to try and improve ourselves at some point during the past hour and a half. So I see, in my mind, that's a contradiction. Contentment versus improving ourselves. So that's a pretty, I don't know, that seems like a pretty heavy contradiction in my mind.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's one that I've heard many, many, many times in the past. And, you know, I just come to the conclusion that as discontented people, we're not content with contentment either. And to understand that contentment doesn't mean complacency. Contentment doesn't mean that you just don't do anything anymore. It's not the opposite of improvement. Contentment also means being content with the opportunities that we have to improve ourselves. How's that? Contentment with the opportunities that come about, which come about fairly regularly, to improve ourselves, to, you know, to diminish our mental afflictions, to, you know, amp up our sense of love and connection with others and so forth. And those opportunities are happening on a moment-to-moment basis. But if you don't accept the moment on a moment-to-moment, if you're not content in accepting of those opportunities, then how can you ever improve yourself? You see what I mean? How can there ever really be improvement if you're not accepting the opportunities for improvement? So something to think about, okay? You know, it's a big question. It does seem like at least initially, like a contradiction to say, well, you know, practice contentment while you also have the obligation, you know, in life to try to make yourself better. And I mean, you know, spiritually, not necessarily economically or like that, you know, but spiritually, the whole point of life is to improve ourselves. But how can we do that if we're constantly discontent? You see, people sometimes associate improvement with discontentment. Well, I'm going to improve myself because I'm so discontent. But maybe to think about it in a kind of an inside-out way, we can improve ourselves only if we're content with the opportunities that we have to improve ourselves. Right? Put it in the pipe and smoke it for a while.
I was just wondering, what kind of spiritual direction would you give to somebody that kind of feels like the Holy Spirit is awakening, that sort of teaches awakening in them? Maybe they don't live there 100% of the time, but they know how to get back to it when they pop into the ego again.
Is that Andrea?
Yes.
Are you basically asking how to remember something that you already know? Sorry, what was the word? A miss what?
It's more than I would have dreamed of.
Oh, immense love, yep. Well, look, you're fortunate. I mean, if you recognize or are having experience like that and are recognizing it, you're very, very fortunate. And that's the grace, you know. You have received grace. From the grace of God, if you want to call it that. Of course, we all have the potential to, you know, to have that experience, to have that understanding all the time. But sometimes, for reasons that we can't really account for, we have this sense of blessedness, of living a blessed life, and that's very, very valuable. Those moments are very, very important. And the reason I was prompting you before about remembering is I think that, you know, in my experience, the trick is to remember those, is to not forget them or not discount them and think, oh, that was just some weird stage I was going through or, you know, whatever. But to recognize and remember them as being moments where we were in touch with reality. And to long for those moments, you know, to have a kind of nostalgia for those moments and want to try to retrieve them. In the devotional traditions of India, the bhakti traditions, they call this love in separation, where, you know, they kind of argue that the love that we experience when we're separated from our beloved, when we can't be with the one we love, is actually one of the most deepest and purest kinds of love. It's a love that kind of wrenches our heart. You know, it goes deep, and so you can like think about that in terms of those, you know, kind of experiences that you've had where you got a glimpse. You have had a glimpse of the Holy Spirit moving within you, of God. You had a glimpse of it, and to cultivate that kind of nostalgia, to cultivate that kind of love in separation, you know, is a kind of a deep motivation, actually, for for trying to get back there. You know, got to get ourselves back to the garden. There's a whole kind of theme like this running through a lot of religions that we need to remember. My teacher, the very one that I was quoting earlier, Mircea Eliade, also said that for the spiritual person, the greatest sin is forgetting. The greatest sin is forgetting those moments, forgetting those like glimpses that we had, forgetting those moments of grace, forgetting what we already know, forgetting what we've learned. And so, you know, you can think about coming to classes like this as just another attempt to remind you of something that you already know. It's probably not too much that you heard tonight that you hadn't heard in some form or another before. And so that doesn't mean that we can't, you know, there's no point in coming to class or no point in reviewing a great text like the Bhagavad Gita. The point is to remember. The point is to, you know, is to reawaken something that's already smoldering, smoldering in there, waiting for a little, you know, air to be blown on it so it'll burst into a big fire. Okay, guys, we've gone a little long. Thanks for your patience and perseverance. Please come tomorrow if you can, and next week also. If you can't, you can drop into any one of these classes as we go through them. I'll do a review of each one before we start the next one. And thanks for joining us. It all went well, I think, technologically. It seemed like it did on this end.
Went great. Thank you so much.
Okay, David. Thanks, guys.
See you tomorrow.
Okay, see you tomorrow.
Bye.